from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, in March 2011, an earthquake and tsunami triggered a meltdown of three reactors at the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan. 3 years later, we examined the state of the cleanup, its effect on Japanese politics, and the impact on marine life and the environment. Forum is next. Join us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Tomorrow marks 3 years to the day that a devastating 9.0 earthquake and a series of tsunamis hit Japan 80 miles off the country's coast and crippled the Fukushima nuclear plant, causing a meltdown. The giant tsunami killed some 18,500 people and wiped out entire communities. Tens of thousands of people are still unable to return to their homes around the crippled Fukushima plant, and we take up in this morning's opening Forum hour ongoing questions concerning effects and concerns about the disaster 3 years later, including fears of radiation effects right here in California. We have a panel, and first let me introduce to you Kushida Kushida, who is research associate in Kenji Kushida, who's research associate in Japanese studies at Stanford with the Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center. And Kenji Kushida, good to have you back with us on Forum. Welcome.
Thank you.
We also want to welcome Edwin Lyman, who is joining us from the nation's capital. He's senior scientist with the Global Security Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists and also co-author of a new book, Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. Welcome, Edwin Lyman. Well, Edwin Lyman, do we have you here?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah. At first I couldn't, but now I can. Thank you. We also have Dan Madigan with us, postdoctoral fellow and adjunct assistant professor at Stony Brook University School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences in New York. He formerly worked at Stanford Hopkins Marine Station and was the lead author of a study that found traces of radiation in bluefin tuna. Welcome, Dan Madigan.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And let me begin, if I may, Kenji Kushida, with you. And let's begin by just kind of getting an update. Where are we on the cleanup at this point? And, I mean, decades ahead is what we're reading.
Yeah, the latest projections are that it's going to be about 40 years for total cleanup. And the current two big issues are, first, removing the spent fuels from pools and that are sitting in the damaged reactor buildings. And that's progressing smoothly so far as we know. And the second serious issue is the storage of radioactive contaminated water. In there are 400 tons a day that flow into the damaged reactor buildings. They collect most of those and most of it and store it in tanks. And the tanks have all sorts of problems, like they're overflowing, some are leaking, et cetera. So those are the two big issues right now.
Well, also we had Michio Kaku on recently, and he was talking about the robots not necessarily working the way they should be. And I know there have been delays in safety checks by new atomic regulators and political clashes.
Yes, definitely. The main political issue is whether to restart all the other reactors that Japan has. And there's a new regulatory, a nuclear regulatory authority that has been set up to be an independent organization to assess the safety of these reactors. And right now they're all stopped for safety checks and routine maintenance. There were a couple that were restarted once, but they've shut down for maintenance. So the public is pretty divided on this. In the recent Tokyo gubernatorial election, about 50-something percent were against restarting, and about 30% were for restarting it. But this is a case where one of the cases where a country's domestic politics really affects how this technology is going to be used in the future. And the way that the Japanese politics is progressing right now is that the anti-nuclear movement is split, and people that are also pro-nuclear, plus people who are prioritizing the economy, because the current administration has been able to deliver, under Prime Minister Abe's Abenomics, a burst of economic growth that the country hasn't seen for a long time. So the people that are against restarting these nuclear plants are, A, not necessarily figuring out who's the best candidate for their platform, and a lot of people prioritize the economy over this single issue.
We're talking, by the way, if you just joined us, with Kenji Kushida, who is with Stanford's Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center. And how are these domestic politics affecting the ongoing refugee crisis?
Well, the dynamics are a little separate because, on the one hand, yes, people who have been displaced want to return, and a lot of most of the damage from the tsunami, of course, is a matter of rebuilding. But the areas that are right near the plant, it's a question of radioactivity, and a lot of the areas that were mandatory evacuation zones have been cleared, so people can move back. That being said, they certainly don't feel good when the government now is very pro-nuclear reactor restarting. And so as a psyche, they don't particularly feel like their voices are being heard. And a number of lawsuits have been dismissed, some of them for good reason. But a lot of exploration will happen through the judicial system as well, with people suing the manufacturers of the nuclear plants, of the reactors themselves. And a recently dismissed court case was a criminal case against the head of the leadership of the company, TEPCO, responsible for the nuclear reactors, and the prime minister and his leadership at the time.
That surprised a lot of people. I mean, over 15,000 people filed that criminal complaint back in 2012 because their farms or their homes were hit by radiation, and prosecutors in Japan dropped all the charges. Essentially, they said no one's accountable for the disaster or its aftermath.
Yeah, it's a tough call because criminal, the issue was that it was a criminal case. So was there criminal intent? And actually, I've done a couple analyses of the decision-making during the crisis itself, and the prime minister basically inherited these problems because their party came into power just before, 2 years before the disaster. And some of the actions he took during the crisis itself did quite a bit to mitigate the situation that could have been a lot worse. Now, TEPCO leadership, this is a better question, and some legitimate criticism is that the prosecutor's office should have gone and at least raided TEPCO's offices looking for documents before dismissing the case. But the problem was that these things were tied. It was against the prime minister and his leadership, political leadership, as well as the TEPCO leadership altogether. And the political side, I don't think it actually would stand up in a criminal case.
Well, they ruled that it was a man-made disaster. There was nothing wrong in terms of TEPCO. And by the way, TEPCO is the Tokyo Electric Power Company. It's hard to prove negligence. Again, we're talking, if you just joined us, about Fukushima 3 years after. Kenji Kushida is Stanford University Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center Research Associate in Japanese Studies. And Edward Lyman is Senior Scientist with Global Security Program of Union of Concerned Scientists, co-author of the new book, Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. And Edwin Lyman, I'm just wondering about all this. I mean, what can happen now in terms of regulatory policy? It's kind of hard to, at this point, gauge where they're going to move in Japan. What do you sense?
Well, in Japan, the new Nuclear Regulation Authority developed a new set of rules to govern the restarts. And in that, they tried to adopt a philosophy which involved more what's called defense in depth. And one of the problems that contributed to Fukushima is the inability of regulators everywhere to really anticipate the unexpected and make sound judgments about the contingency plans that you need to have in the event that things turn out worse than you anticipated. So I think the Japanese NRA had developed safety plans which look good on paper, but I am also concerned about the political pressure that the regulator is under. It was created to be more independent than the previous regulatory authority in Japan.
Well, what was the previous regulatory authority? I thought there was a non-existent nuclear regulatory.
Well, it was called NISA, the Nuclear Industrial Safety Agency, and that was under the Economics Ministry in Japan, so which was charged with promoting nuclear power. So the idea is that the new agency is, I believe, under the Ministry of the Environment now, which is supposed to
make it more independent, supposedly.
Well, in theory,
yeah.
But if you have the national government putting out an energy policy where it's devoted to trying to resume the status of nuclear power in Japan the way it was before the accident, I think that puts the regulator in a very difficult position. And I understand it's also has a personnel issue in that the reviews that it specified for restarts are so detailed that they're really straining their personnel to be able to complete these in an expedited timetable. And our experience in the United States is that if you try to accelerate safety reviews, it's not usually a very good idea.
No, not a good idea at all. I wonder, though, just from your perspective, Edwin Lyman, how generally the country is recovering from the tsunami.
From the tsunami. I'm not... My expertise really isn't in the general humanitarian aspects of the tsunami. What we have looked at is are the issues associated with long-term contaminated areas. And what did happen after Fukushima is that a pretty large swath of the neighboring areas were contaminated with cesium-137, which is a fairly long-lived radioactive isotope. Persist in the environment for several hundred years. And this has led to a policy issue which is really faced by any country that operates nuclear power plants, is that what standards do you impose for cleanup after a contamination event occurs? Do you try to reduce the contamination back to the levels before the accident, or do you adopt a different standard? And there seems to be a consensus among the industry and regulators that maybe you don't need to clean up to a level that it was before the accident, that you just need to reduce it to a level where you say it's safe. It's not as safe as it was before the accident, but the increased risk is going to be somehow acceptable. And this leads to a lot of difficult policy choices and a lot of difficult decisions on the part of people who are evacuated, because they have to decide sometimes whether to lose their property and not get compensated or to move back to a contaminated house.
Well, I noticed, and we'll talk about some of the monitoring of radiation, but Greenpeace has said that the radiation levels are high enough to raise concerns for the people who are living daily with contamination. Authorities consistently underestimate, according to Greenpeace at least, the risks and the extent of radioactive contamination. That's contrary to what Japanese authorities have said. For example, Greenpeace saying children should be kept from schools.
Well, the real problem is that the deposition of radioactivity was not uniform. It was extremely heterogeneous. So you have a lot of hot spots that are accumulating, and you can't make judgments about how safe a particular area is and extrapolate that to something that's just a few meters away. So one thing that's been proposed is that people who want to return to contaminated areas should be equipped with personal dosimeters so that they can have a better idea of what the radiation environment is as they go from one place to another. But, it's very hard to do surveys that are extensive enough to make sure that you're not going to miss some of these hot spots.
Again, Edwin Lyman with us from the nation's capital, senior scientist with the Global Security Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Dan Madigan's a postdoctoral fellow and adjunct assistant professor at Stony Brook School of Marine and Atmospheric Science. Formerly worked at Stanford Hopkins Marine Station, was the lead author of a study that found traces of radiation in bluefin tuna. And Dan, let's talk about that first. I mean, they swim the great length of bluefin tuna, and they've been singled out. And there's actually higher radiation levels, I understand, of flounder in Japan. Japanese concerned about eating flounder at this point.
What we found in the bluefin has turned out to be pretty unique in terms of migratory species, in the sense that they were a logical first species to look at away from Japan, because their early life history is pretty well understood and constrained. They're all spawned in the West Pacific, and any ones that are, for example, waters off California had to come from the western side of the Pacific Ocean at some point. And because of this, you know that the smallest ones had to come fairly recently, because they can't swim over in, say, the larval stage. They have to reach some size before they make that migration. So they were the first migratory animals we looked at away from Fukushima waters. And the results in 2012 and 2013 were amazingly consistent, that all the individuals of the size you'd expect to have recently migrated and therefore to carry some measurable radioactivity from Fukushima, and we were measuring this radiocesium isotopes that have already been discussed, cesium 134 and 137.
Let me just clarify that, Dan, for listeners, because I think 134 could only come from Fukushima. 137 delays a lot later. It's, in fact, often associated with nuclear testing, yeah?
Right. So actually, nuclear testing would produce both as well. So the difference is that is in their half-lives. Cesium-134 has a half-life of 2 years. So that means after 2 years, whatever amount was put out, half of it's left.
Opposed to 30 years, right?
As opposed to 30 years, exactly. Yeah. So basically, in the time frame we're talking about since Fukushima, relatively very little cesium-137 would have decayed, whereas a good proportion, you know, more than half now, of the cesium-134 would have decayed by now. And we're finding that. The initial ratio that came out of the plant was about 1-to-1. And we basically found that in the tuna that we measured. We found about a 1-to-1 ratio, and now we're seeing less than 50%. As in, there's more than twice the cesium-137 than there is 134 in the fish that have 134. So 134, for example, in weapons testings in the 50s and 60s, cesium-134 was also released, but it's long since decayed. Whereas a little bit of, you know, it has various terms, but a little bit of basically leftover or background cesium-137 still remains from those weapons testing. So there's a little bit of a cesium-137 legacy in the Pacific Ocean, whereas cesium-134, for the most part, if you find it, you know it's from fairly recent events, and it takes a pretty massive amount to go into the ocean to be able to make its way into food chain. So that was pretty much the smoking gun indicator of the radio cesium coming from Fukushima.
Well, let me go right to the heart of what I suppose is on many people's minds here in California, and that is, what do we know in terms of the danger of radiation reaching the Pacific coast by April, as some have speculated? Woods Hole oceanographic studies say not likely. There are studies coming out of Vancouver and up in Canada that say radiation poses no threat here in California. What's your take?
So this is something people usually want a short answer, and it's something that we've struggled with because it's not so straightforward. First of all, the models that predict the spread across the Pacific Ocean and it reaching the Eastern Pacific at some certain time is pretty much totally agreed upon, as in some amount of radioactive cesium and potentially other isotopes will cross the Pacific Ocean. The question is in the amounts. A lot of people aren't aware of the fact that there are radioactive elements around us all the time. You're almost constantly exposed, or you are constantly exposed to some background amount of radioactivity. The problem is in the amount, or the danger is in the dose. So the question really is not if it will reach the Pacific coast, but will the amount of it in the water or in food be enough to really be considerable? And then you dive into that question as well. What amount matters?
And what about the kelp forest? They have to figure that in too, don't we?
They do. I mean, the kelp forest, that's so I don't know if you're referring to this directly, but there's the kelp watch study that's going on.
Right.
And they are trying to use kelp basically as an indicator species. You know, kelp runs up and down the coast of the intertidal of the western United States coastline, and it takes in, it basically absorbs a lot of elements to concentrations much higher than surrounding seawater. So they're basically using the kelp as an indicator of if and when the radiocesium makes its way across the ocean and in what kind of amounts. I know they're making those measurements basically now and have been. I haven't heard results from that yet, but they still expect, they have a, you know, there's a website for Kelp Watch. You can go read about it, and they outline it pretty well what they're looking for. And they expect the cesium to be in levels much lower than, for example, radioactive potassium. And the radioactive potassium has nothing to do with Fukushima or even man's activities. That's naturally found in the earth. And they expect levels to be thousands of times less than what's already in the kelp from natural processes. So, again, the question is really in the amount of the radioactivity. And the amounts we have found in the fish, we've always tried to put into context. We don't want to say it's totally safe, and we don't want to say, if we don't think it is, that it's dangerous either. But we want to put it in the context. And the context is that there, even in the first bluefin tuna, which proved to be the ones that had the most, as opposed to latter years where we found less and less radiocesium from Fukushima, there's a lot more radioactive potassium, and again, that's naturally occurring in the fish, about 100 times more than there is of the radioactive cesium. That means that if you were eating tuna before this ever happened, you were eating 100 times more radioactivity just in the form of radioactive potassium, and that's been the case since people ate tuna. I mean, this would have been in the fish 2,000 years ago.
Not to mention the mercury, huh?
Yeah, exactly. That always comes in somehow.
Dan Madigan with us by phone, and you can be with us by phone. In fact, I'd like to give out the phone number now and invite those of you listening to join the program with any questions or comments you might have. We're talking about Fukushima. Tomorrow marks 3 years after the earthquake and tsunami triggered a meltdown of three reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant in Japan. And 3 years later, talking about the state of the cleanup, its effect on Japanese politics, the impact on marine life and the environment. And your voices are welcome to be heard here. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. And again, we welcome your phone calls, and you can join us whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Toll-free again, 866-733-6786. You can also communicate with us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or posting anything that's on your mind onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And, of course, you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Talking with Dan Madigan from Stony Brook, the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences, and with Edwin Lyman, who is with the Union of Concerned Scientists, also co-author of a new book, Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster, and with Kenji Kushida, who is a research associate in Japanese studies at Stanford Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center. We'll hear from you when we return. Stay tuned. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are reflecting on the Fukushima nuclear disaster 3 years to the day tomorrow from when that disaster first occurred. And Dan Madigan is with us from Stony Brook University School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences, and Edwin Lyman with us, senior scientist with the Global Security Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists and co-author of Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. And Kenji Kushida, who is research associate in Japanese studies at Stanford University Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center. We're going to go right to your calls and emails and online comments. And before we do, though, Kenji Kushida, I wanted to just get your response to a question I asked earlier about how I know the rebuilding is going very slow, and we've got nearly 270,000 people who remain displaced 3 years later. Give me your sense of how you gauge just the whole well, adapting to this disaster now that we're 3 years apart?
Well, the choices facing these families that have been displaced are rather stark, right? On the one hand, some of the people who are displaced have started rebuilding their new lives in different parts of Japan. On the other hand, many people still live in temporary government-provided housing and are waiting to move back in some form. But then they need jobs and then they need capital. And the there's a rather large fund for victims' compensation that is being paid out, originally funded by TEPCO, through the, administered by the government. And the payments are getting to people, but as these things usually are, not as quickly as some would like. So the this is definitely taking a toll on people. And it does seem to be a little bit divorced from the debates over whether to start the national debates and debates among people who live not very close to the reactors, to whom this is sort of something that's happening at a distance, who are interested primarily in economic growth, in jobs, in, yes, let's restart the reactors as long as they're safe enough, or those who are a little ambivalent about sustained reliance on nuclear power on the one hand. And so there's this little disconnect between people who are thinking of the nuclear plant decommissioning and restarting of new ones versus a lot of people who are very focused on the plight of these refugees and people who have had to been who are displaced throughout the country.
Well, let me focus just for a moment more on that nuclear issue with Edwin Lyman, again, who's with the Union of Concerned Scientists, because I noticed out of the bulletin of the atomic scientists, there was a report that the Japanese haven't learned what they describe as the lessons from the reactor disaster, especially the human factor. And I'm looking at one of our listener online comments here, Edwin Lyman. Frank writes, "What a huge price Japan has paid to be a part of the nuclear energy club. They could have used thorium instead of uranium, but that would not have profited the power brokers and corporations, so they didn't. Now it's too large to undo what's been done. Part of their land and therefore their heritage is destroyed forever. In a tightly packed country, every square mile matters, making this tragedy worse still."
Well, in our view, first of all, part of the reason why we wrote our book was we don't see this as a unique Japanese disaster. We see in the roots of the accident trends that are really prevalent all around the world wherever nuclear power plants operate. In fact, here at home, the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission was aware for decades of some of the vulnerabilities especially of the type of reactor that struck, that was present in Fukushima. They were aware of these vulnerabilities for decades and did not take firm actions to try to correct them. And so we think that the NRC actually set a bad example. Now, the caller refers to thorium. We also say in our book that that design issues are only part of the solution. It's really the regulatory context in which reactor designs are licensed that matters, because no matter how safe the reactor design is, if you don't have the proper regulatory context, and especially if you don't have operations regulated to the standard that they should be, then a better design is not going to save you. And that's true for a whole array of variations of the reactor designs that are now common around the world.
Well, I want to get one more thought from Dan Madigan about what we also discussed with him, and that is the safety of food, because I've got another online contribution from a listener named Beth, who says, Dan, that she's concerned about the fact that parts of homes and motorcycles and other stuff has made its way to the shores of Alaska and Washington State and Hawaii, and doesn't that suggest that a lot of fish and seafood can be very contaminated, and maybe officials ought to be more concerned about food safety?
So things that float won't necessarily move in the same way. There's two things here. Things that float don't necessarily move in the same way that things are as things that are dissolved in seawater. The other aspect to consider, and I also want to point out, I'm not saying that or suggesting that it won't necessarily be problematic at all. But so far, all the information that's been put forth has suggested that. I think a lot of people didn't know. I mean, in some ways, in many ways, this was a unique thing to happen to the Pacific Ocean. So people weren't sure what they'd measure. But I would not say that agencies are unconcerned. We've seen a lot of measurements. It turns out that measurements of zero don't get as much attention as measurements of anything else. So there are people who have looked at species up and down the coast of California and Canada, and looking at more residential species that don't travel across the entire Pacific Ocean, and haven't found anything yet. That doesn't mean it won't happen, and that doesn't mean there aren't trace amounts in the water already, but it does mean that so far, whatever trace amounts may be there haven't made it into food chains in any detectable amount.
It's sort of like cream and coffee, I've been reading, right? I mean, that's the analogy that keeps coming up, as opposed to motorcycles and things of that size. The cream just spreads out, and then, you know, you have to go to the trouble of, and difficulty and sometimes the enigma of actually measuring and quantifying. Well, let me bring our callers on here. And Dale, you're first up. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Michael. Thanks for the show. It's long overdue. It's been 3 years since this accident, and your analogy about cream and coffee is very pertinent. However, the point I'm trying to make is that this whoever's pouring the cream is still pouring. This is 3 years, and the Japanese government has admitted that it's not just what happened on March 11th of 2011. There's 330 tons daily that the Japanese of radioactive water the Japanese government has admitted has been happening daily into the Pacific Ocean. So it's not like a one thing; it's continuous. And my the question I have for your guests is how they feel about the fact that we have what really should be eliciting an international response to an accident of this size is being mitigated by a corporation in Japan, which has its eye on their bottom line and has limited resources, even with the government of Japan supplementing things. Shouldn't there really be a level of international response to Fukushima, which has been rated, along with Chernobyl, at 7 on the international event scale from the International Atomic Energy Agency? This actually exceeds the level 7 in many respects because it's ongoing and hasn't been mitigated.
Yeah, although in many respects Chernobyl was worse. But Kenji Kushida, can I get you to respond to the remarks we just heard from Dale?
Yes. So the ongoing, I mean, this crisis doesn't stop. It keeps on going, and there's no easy solution in sight. Is TEPCO doing the best they can? Well, it's not obvious given the way that some of the reports are coming out. For example, the Nuclear Regulatory Authority has said that the tanks should be only filled up to about 95% capacity to make sure there's no spillage. A recent expose just found that the TEPCO had been disarming a couple of the full alarms that go off when there's enough too much water in there, and they'd been filling them up to 99%, and then there had been some leakage as a result of this. The tanks have been bolted together instead of welded, and anybody knows that you should weld something to hold water, partly because the four suppliers, only one of them could do the welding. The other three had actually sent personnel into the disaster zone right after, and this was sort of payback for them. So having a corporation manage this does have its challenges. That being said, the government did step in to financially back the company and then replaced its top management with somebody that they trust. So there are organizational challenges, but at the top, the government has said that the buck stops with us. Whether that's actually followed through on the level of the on the ground, that's a big question. And should there be more international help? Yes, absolutely. One of the critiques of the early stages of the crisis, as soon as the reactors were cooled down a bit, was that more international help should have come in and they should have been more open to that. TEPCO spent the first few months sort of digging its heels in until it almost became basically de facto nationalized because its payments were untenable. So That being said, this current situation is basically unprecedented. It's not like there's a certain series of well-proved international practices, best practices that can be just applied here, and Japan is resisting. It's a process of co-developing the best practices on how to do this. And so that, and the my understanding is the extraction of the spent fuels rods, there were about 1,500 of them at the time of the crisis sitting at the top of the reactors that were closed for maintenance. They're basically picture some swimming pools that are high up in a building, and most of the building has blown off with the hydrogen explosions. Very tenuous. And some of the aftershocks, like magnitude 7.0, I mean, that's a very big earthquake in itself. So that's what the concern was, that these big spent fuel pools would rupture, and then you'd have a chain reaction of the spent fuel, and then you'd have to abandon the plant, and then a chain reaction to the rest of eastern Japan. So that part has received quite a bit of international help to help reinforce these damaged buildings and then to safely extract these spent fuel rods from the pools and put into what's called dry caskets that are much more secure for long-term stabilization and storage of these rods. So yes, definitely, more international cooperation could be there. That being said, it's not easy. The TEPCO certainly could be more competent, but of course they're having trouble getting enough people to work there because you can only work there a limited amount of time before you get enough radiation that you're not allowed to work there anymore. So, but these are some of the...
Let me thank Dale for his call and remind you that Kenji Kushida's with Stanford's Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center, a research associate in Japanese studies. And let me go right to another caller, and that's Max. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for a good program, as usual. We hear a lot about contamination of water, seawater. There is some contamination of the air. Of course, the reactors pose a huge problem still. And you mentioned briefly the issue with the surrounding, the contamination of the surrounding areas. But then, here we're talking about at some point the removal of topsoil, the destruction of buildings to remove debris. That's a monumental task. You're talking millions of tons, potentially. Has this been properly assessed? That's my question.
Edward Lyman.
Well, yes. The decontamination of the surrounding areas is turning out to be a major challenge, and it has not been done in a thoughtful or consistent way. You can remove contaminated topsoil, but there's no long-term plan for what you do with it. In many communities, this contaminated soil has just been piling up in makeshift above-ground storage sites. Japan has never given serious consideration to a long-term strategy for disposal of its nuclear waste. And it's not alone in that. No country really has. But it is faced with the additional issues of how to dispose of all that remediated material. Also, decontamination is not always proving that effective. And recent studies have shown that although cesium will eventually work its way down into lower levels of the soil so that it's less of an external radiation hazard, there hasn't been a significant reduction in the cesium levels in many of the contaminated areas. Sometimes decontamination is reversed when additional sources of contamination wash into decontaminated areas. So they are faced with a massive challenge.
And again, Edwin Lyman with us from Washington, D.C., a senior scientist with Global Security Program for the Union of Concerned Scientists. I want to thank the caller and go to a Phoenix caller. Amelia, you're on forum. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, my question is about radiation. I don't really know much about it, but I was wondering, is there a difference in the health effect from the background potassium radiation that the speaker described from the cesium that we're seeing now? And my second question is actually, is there an additive effect? So I know lots of times we say, well, this, you know, if you keep under this level for this particular thing, then you're okay. But what about the additive effect of all of the different types of radiation and the addition of this new radiation to our water in our food supply.
Yeah, let me go again to you on this, Edwin Lyman, if I may.
Yes, well, there's no real difference between background radiation in general and artificial radiation. The differences really have to do with the particular nature of the radiation. So ionizing radiation affects the body differently depending on what type it is and how it's delivered. So certain radioactive isotopes do not stay very long in the body, but others do. Plutonium or strontium might work their way into lung tissue or bone tissue, and you live with that body burden the rest of your life. And also depending on whether the radiation is what's called alpha decay, which are fairly heavy charged particles, or beta or gamma decay is high energy photons, that really affects the way the radiation can harm the body. So, and radioactivity is certainly a cumulative effect. In addition to whatever background radiation we're exposed to, the additional dose from artificial sources will contribute and increase our cancer risk above that background.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at an email. Let me thank Amelia for her call from a listener named Dave, who says, "Seems to me people are hypersensitive to any radiation in the environment. However, is this really a problem from Fukushima? There's background radiation that we live with constantly, and there's really no evidence that any of this radiation is going to cause additional sickness, cancers, etc. So how serious is the problem? Do we really expect any additional cancers in California from radiation from Fukushima?" It's a question we don't necessarily have an answer to, I would imagine, at this point, Edwin Lyman.
Well, we do have an answer, because it is the connection between ionizing radiation exposure and increased cancer risk is very well established. So we do know that because the accident deposited radioactivity into the environment that wasn't there before, that is going to cause additional radiation doses to people, that will be associated with additional disease. Now, the question is whether that'll be a strong enough signal that an epidemiological study will be able to detect it and prove causation. That's a different issue. But sometimes people tend to confuse the two. They think if it can't be detected, then it's not there. But simply extrapolating from first principles, there's radiation in the environment that wasn't there before, people are exposed, that will cause additional disease.
Well, in fact, let me just read a few more emails that are on point here. Peter writes, while we're on the subject of radiation reaching California from Asia, how does the radiation from Fukushima compare quantitatively with the radiation reaching us from China in the form of carbon-14 from coal-burning power plants, not to mention the associated smog and soot and the well-known and quantifiable premature deaths those cause here in the United States? How does our exposure to cesium-137 here compare, say, to our exposure from natural potassium-40 that we get from eating bananas? I don't deny that nuclear power has its risks or that the Japanese government has glossed over problems at Fukushima, but the fact that radiation could be found in, say, tuna is not shocking nor indicative in itself of the magnitude of the disaster. It speaks as much to the phenomenal sensitivity of our instruments as it does to anything else. Remember, Avogadro's number is over 10 to the 26th, and Dan Madigan, you say what to that?
Sorry, to which part?
Well, again, this is making the point that radiation is coming from many more sources, and we have really sensitive technical instruments that can measure it a lot better. So that may be part of the equation and probably is.
Yes, definitely. I mean, one of the things we say, just as Edward said, I believe, just because you can't detect it doesn't mean it's not there. It also means that just because you can't, the flip side of that is just because you can detect it doesn't mean it's a lot. And as the listener points out, it does point to the sensitivity of instruments. For example, if you waved a Geiger counter, which a lot more people are familiar with, over the tuna samples we measured, you wouldn't read a thing. You wouldn't think that these were, it wouldn't go off, so to speak. We're talking about measuring amounts that you need very sophisticated equipment and to measure, and you actually need to block that sample with lead to not get to not be influenced by all the background radiation that is around you all the time. So that's a good point in that, yes, the amount can be measured, but again, it all depends on the amount. And these trace amounts that we've measured, it takes sophisticated instrumentation even to pick it up.
And since a point was brought up by a listener about the importance of international cooperation, even 3 years later, on many levels with Fukushima, I want to read an online comment from a listener named Idom, who said the following. I spent 13 years in the nuclear engineering department at UC Berkeley. I must say that the Fukushima incident is much worse than what we are told and is a ticking bomb, and it must be addressed by a joint effort of all the nations of the world. All of Japan's efforts to fix the problem have been more like a joke, and a real solution must be found very soon. Otherwise, the net results will be a disaster that exceeds the one at Chernobyl. Let me go to more of your calls. We go to Half Moon Bay. Stephen, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. First thing I want to say is thank you for the well-thought-out program and for public radio, because I'm not sure you can get commercial sponsors to pay for this program. I have two questions. They're kind of practical questions. I have three college degrees, and I'm having a hard time following some of the conversation. It's very high-level stuff that I'm not really familiar with in terms of science. So what I would just ask your callers is, without, you know, getting yourselves into trouble, is there kind of practical recommendations that you would make or suggest for people to follow as far as food, drink, or behaviors, you know, here on the ground, say, for example, here in California or the United States, about what we should be either eat, drink, or do, or have our kids do, or things we might want to measure. And the other thing is, after all the research that you've done, do you believe that there is any safe type of nuclear power, given what we know about governments and corporations and just human nature?
Well, you're raising two very fundamental questions, of which there's been a lot of debate just on this program, not advertised, as you say, by anybody. Edwin Lyman, I'd like to hear your thoughts and wisdom perhaps on this. First of all, what people can do, what normal citizens ought to do with respect to protecting themselves against the radiation that's obviously out there.
Well, in this particular context, my impression is that the people in the West Coast do not need to take any special precautions. And of course, you can never say never, but I'll give a reason why. When the accidents first occurred, and a very large amount of radioactive material was deposited into the atmosphere, 80% of that actually went over the Pacific Ocean. And the U.S. government was actually very worried at that time, because they didn't know how bad things were going to get. They were running computer simulations, which we document in the book, that found out that in the worst case, there might even be enough contamination of, let's say, milk from cows that were grazing on the West Coast, that they might have to interdict milk supplies. Now, that didn't happen, and it turns out the accident was nowhere near the worst case that they were projecting. And so the situation today is many orders of magnitude below what happened in the weeks after the accident. So I just say that if we didn't see the signals then that would have triggered serious health concerns here in this country, I don't think we have to worry.
Well, but what about something like seaweed in Japanese food that comes from Japan? I mean, should we be concerned about eating that?
Well, this is a problem because I think because of the heterogeneous nature of the way these isotopes travel and are, you know, bioaccumulated, that, you know, there are potential hot spots or things. You can never sample everything and test everything. So you're going to have to go by the statistics of if the level of sampling you're doing is sufficient to say the food supply is going to be generally safe. So, again, you can't say never.
And you can't say never about safety of nuclear power, which that caller also brought up.
Yeah.
I mean, France is always highlighted as an example of safety of nuclear power, but you've got human beings involved, so you can't really obviously tell. I've also got an email here, Edwin Lyman, from a listener, actually, who asked, a real disaster, Japan's carbon emissions have increased 10% since they closed all the nuclear plants?
Well, they did have to make up that capacity from somewhere, and they've been doing that primarily through imports of natural gas. So so certainly carbon emissions have increased. And the is an issue because, for all its warts, nuclear power is one of the electricity sources that generates smaller amounts of greenhouse gas. So we do have to balance its benefits against its risks. But the fact is that if nuclear power is not regulated as safely and securely as it can be, then it will take itself off the table as an option. I'm not sure how many more Fukushimas the industry could tolerate before the public worldwide just gives up completely in disgust. So it's counterproductive if the industry and the regulators are not willing to do everything they can to make sure it's safe.
I've got a quick tweet here, which...
Michael, can I make one quick comment on the seafood consumption?
Yeah, go ahead, Dan Madigan.
One thing I've noticed with all these people, with people being very concerned, and that I always tell them is that if they don't trust that these levels are indeed low and that low levels aren't not enough to calm their fears, you know, being worried isn't great for you either. Anxiety is not healthy either, and
bad for the immune system.
Exactly. The only two species that have been shown to have this radioactivity from Fukushima that are accessible in the U.S. are Pacific bluefin and albacore tuna, and these do not need to be staples of anyone's diet for the most part. So I always say, if you're going to worry about it, it's not worth it. Just eat something else.
Well,
I mean, that's it. If you're going to be that concerned, then just switch to a different type of seafood or a different type of food altogether.
Sage advice, and thank you for that, Dan Madigan. And thank you to all our panelists, Dan Madigan from Stony Brook and Edwin Lyman from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Again, his new book is Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster, and Kenji Kushida from Stanford University Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center. And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. You can continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org/forum. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.